Hi, it's Connor from Tattoo, mobile search engine based in Cambridge. Just to open up the mobile debate from you gentlemen, I've heard two words this evening, individual and context. Mobile industry would be of the view that the mobile will dominate as a micromedia channel. Given the average consumer in the UK looks at their mobile screen 25 times a day, I guess in anticipation of a text message from a friend or whomever. So if you could discuss mobile, that would be useful.
Mobile. Gert wants to have a go.
Well, to me, you know, this mobile is... There's no real difference between the mobile web and the web, right? I mean, this is just a question of interface. So as I was thinking earlier on the print and the paper debate, you know, paper is one interface for information. Right? It's a good one. Another one is the paper or a surface computer or a mobile or whatever. And the mobile, to me, is, you know, what's happening there is that we have a different way of interacting of the interface, but everything else is the same. Right? Why would it be any different? I mean, in the end, I act differently because I'm on the mobile, but what I get to see there and do there is pretty much the same now, right? I mean, you see with the iPhone, the new Nokia phone, it's all heading towards mobile devices, and especially in Asia, you know, 100-to-1. People won't be sitting around a big box and to do these things, right? It'll be a mobile device. So I totally agree with you. I think that is the channel for media, clearly. But is it any different than the computer? I don't think so. It's just a different kind of computer.
What are the impediments? What's stopping it right now?
Well, I mean, there's the obvious things like of course, the network power and those kind of things. But when we have mesh networks, meaning that you can go online in 50 different ways, which is coming, right? Clearly, in 2 years, we have that. So you can have Wi-Fi, WiMAX, you know, 4G, whatever. You can mash all the access networks, and you've got all the interfaces, including projection of the screen, which is coming, right? All these things are coming. So I don't see any reason why it's not going to come. I think it's just a little bit later. And I think there's been research, of course. China Mobile has said that 95% of the time, the mobile is within 1 meter of the person, right? So that's completely different than the computer, right? These are not computers in that sense, right? And of course, think of wristwatches and sunglasses and all these kind of things, which kind of sounds like Star Wars or something, but it's here. Right? So think of the same for print. You know, if I can read your newspaper on my sunglasses projected, I can already do that, except that costs 100,000 quid. So give it a few more years, it will happen.
Yeah, go ahead. You going to answer this one, Miles?
Well, yeah, I just want to kind of wade in and kick the music industry again. I mean, I think... is anybody here from the music industry? Hi, sorry. We would dearly love to stream music, Last.fm, your personal radio. I mean, we've got a good user here. You know, you build up a profile of yourself. If you can stream your music profile on a phone, we would love it. At the moment, the chances of that happening with rights... is about 5 years away. So actually for mobile, for music, you either do it illegally, which CBS Corporation probably won't want to do, or you wait. And this, you know, and this all comes back to doing things legally and actually waking up an industry that's even more dinosauric than, if that's a word, than the media industry. So but we were waiting to embrace.
So that was simultaneously a good kicking for the music industry and the operators, presumably, there, yeah? On 90% of tariffs, you'd be insane to stream music, wouldn't you?
Second.
You'd be insane to stream music on my current Vodafone tariff, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, it would use a lot of data, but it actually goes back to the big four, so Sony, EMI, Warner, and the other one. You can see I don't work in that side of it, but you know the money that they're asking for to stream on mobile is just the economics don't stack up. We would be bust within about 6 weeks.
And why are they holding this up when they seem to be much more ready to see it happen online?
We have the four major labels signed up, but the last one only signed this year. So, you know, I think there's a big, big problem. And we can only stream songs 3 times. And, you know, we've got the world's biggest catalogue. So there's still a big inertia with... EMI actually waking up, probably because of Guy. But, you know, the music industry is waking up. And, you know, we can prove that we're increasing sales. But they're still a bit slow.
Actually, I wanted to go to the lady behind.
The lady at the back there looks like she might have an answer. Right, instead of maybe possibly just a question.
I don't have an answer. My name's Nicola Sade. I work for a music industry publication called Record of the Day. Hello. I'd like you to explain a bit more about that, the fact that they won't... Is that really a rights issue? Because there's Nokia Comes With Music coming up soon, and there's no rights issue there, so why would that be the case with you guys?
That's preloaded. This is through the, you know, we are a radio station effectively online, streaming music via Wi-Fi, WiMAX, whatever you wanted to call it, is cost prohibitive. To have music on your phone, God, absolutely, and that's easy. But you're not streaming over the airwaves. Streaming over the airwaves absolutely is a no-no at the moment.
There are streaming services out there on your mobile though.
Yeah, they're illegal.
Right, okay. Just out of interest, what kind of, I mean, are we talking like thousands, millions? I mean, what kind of advances are they asking for?
A lot.
Go on, put this into some kind of context here.
I can't.
Ugh, damn you.
nice try, anyway. First at the front there.
Hey, Omid Ashtari working.
The pillar.
Hey, Omid Ashtari working for Google and BizDev. I wanted to throw an idea in here, or something that I was concerned with recently. I read an article, I think it was on Mashable. They were talking about the ownership of the user-generated content. Basically, I'm fueling a site with the micro content that I'm creating, and presumably that is owned by the platform itself. Or not, thanks for clarifying. But I just wanted to throw the idea in there. Why aren't there more sites out there that are incentivizing the user to create more and more content? As we see on MySpace and all these social networks, the people actually like to do that. And I think there are a lot of like traditional publishers and other websites are still really slow in adopting this incentivization to create content for those platforms. And how do you see that? How do you think we can push that more?
Do you mean the idea that a platform owner might split advertising revenue with a creator?
Exactly. Yeah. At the end of the day, basically, I mean, I guess creating content that other people read on that platform, but I'm not getting anything for that. And in the end of the day, I would probably produce more content if you would give me a share of the ad revenue, right? Not wanting to say that added revenue is probably the best way to go forward in these models.
Mitch, what's MySpace's position on that? Do you split revenue?
I mean, it's overhead for running user-generated content is tremendous. We have, like, just for approving photos, we employ hundreds of people to manually look through every single photo that you guys upload to make sure that it's okay. So I think that's probably what's getting in the way is security and the overhead for running user-generated content is just tremendous. And you have to plan to have a huge, you know, site if you're going to do user-generated content because of that overhead cost.
Okay, Gert?
You know, I think it's quite simple. We've up to now lived in a world where ownership of something was completely defined, right? I mean, you own it, you create it, you keep it, life of the author, da-da-da. It's basically completely nailed down. It's like patents, right? I mean, everything is nailed down square, and if you want in, you have to buy into the box, right? Last.fm has to buy the right to stream, right? So what we're getting into now is that copyright is no longer linear, meaning that it changes. And after you create something, it changes again, right? So this completely screws up the idea of the original copy that's, you know, sacrosanct and that is sitting there and is being paid for and all these things. Now it's the context around the creation that also becomes valuable. So in other words, the context becomes the content, right? And this is why I would agree, content is king, but it's not that content, it's all the content around the content, right? Which is interesting. Of course, you know, eBay or Amazon or Last.fm or MySpace create content, but it's not the music or the media, it's the clicks and the users and the interactions. That's also content, right? So we have this problem that this is non-linear and it can't be proclaimed to be owned by one person. We're going to Africa, essentially, right, where the musicians never owned anything. The tribe made the music. Right? Simple as that. So I think this is sort of the tribe situation that we're heading into. And this will make it much harder for the musician to claim that they are the only ones that have written, you know, a 1-6-2-5 chord progression. Yeah.
Fantastically difficult for musicians and creators to accustom themselves to this new model, though. You'll appreciate, I'm sure.
Actually, I think this is really good for musicians, right? Because remember that it's not the musicians that actually got to own the copyright, right?
Unless you're Cliff Richard.
Right. Except for the 0.0002% that were rich enough to actually benefit from it. Right? I mean, the reality is that most musicians, and of course I was one of them for a long time, you never make any money selling copies anyway. Right? So if it comes back this way, it doesn't hurt most of us, it just hurts the people in the middle. Right? That, I mean, it's not a bad thing, it's just a fact. You know, I'm not proclaiming it to be bad or anything. But this is the switch that we're looking at. So the copyright becoming nonlinear, this is like Larry Lessig says, you know, you have a right to prohibit the plane flying above your farm, in theory. But if you have that right, then there can't be airplanes. So it's got to be changed. We're going to have the same thing. You can't have the right to refuse the use of music on the web. You can't. In theory, you can. But in reality, if you do that, then we're finished. Right? And this is what we're seeing right now. This struggle is playing out right now with, you know, with all these last-minute efforts to contain it.
Thank you. We've got a question at the back there. Man in the blue shirt.
Hi. Yeah. I'm Dom. I'm from Hotwire, which is a PR agency. Just tracking back a second. You said it was going to take 5 years for streaming via mobiles to be legal. How much of an issue is content rights really when legalese is kind of so far behind developments anyway that Viacom haven't even properly taken Google to court for the big court case that was due a while back? Is it really an issue? Is it really going to hinder development that much?
Do you mean that just it's being used as an excuse by platform owners and operators and so on?
Well, I kind of think that it's being used as an obstacle when it's a bit of a non-entity, because to some extent the sands are shifting so much so quickly that there's no solid platform for any kind of legal framework to build up quickly enough, and it takes so long to develop anyway that surely any current legal situation doesn't apply to this new environment. And so therefore, is it not that, yeah, there is a threat and a risk of kind of a legal backlash, but it's likely that it will never come, and so it's better just to develop on through it on the basis that you're probably never going to get taken to court anyway?
I like where you're coming from.
Go for it.
I'm not sure if I'd enjoy making that argument to the in-house legal department at Universal, or they'll never sue us, or at the ISP or wherever. Okay, how does our last FM respond to that? Presumably you're all squeaky clean now, you're part of CBS.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, the development of the what we term the audio scrobbler is continuing apace. So we're ready to rock and roll. You know, at the end of the day, if it takes 3 years, we want to be ready. We don't want to be sitting there going, yeah, great, green light, let's now develop this new piece of functionality. The music industry is quite draconian in their legal power. CBS Corporation is quite big. Do we really want to line the pockets of more bloody lawyers? Probably not. You know, if we were still independent, we probably would just go for it, because that's the way Last of M launched back in 2002. Didn't have all the rights at that time. It was Felix and Martin, who were one of the two founders, who decided in 2003 to go legal. So yes and no. I mean, you disconnect your question a bit and say yes, development continues on the basis of doing this legally when we can. Because at the end of the day, I suppose, they could force us to remove the music. They're the ones who supply the music to us. You know, the four big labels plus the hundreds of thousands of smaller independents have to physically supply us with the music. And one day they could say, well, you just ruined it, no way. And then we lose audience, the audience goes somewhere else, and we're all buggered.
Thank you. Question in the middle there.
Hi. Is it working?
Yeah.
I'm Sarah, I work at Clayden Healy. I've got a question that's completely removed, going back a step, what we were talking about before. Somebody up the front mentioned security, and I'd like to ask a question about data. So you mentioned over here the fact that you could make a lot of money perhaps through selling through affiliate schemes. You know a lot about certain people's music taste. You can sell them tickets off the back of that, and that all sounds great. But, you know, when the government proposed this idea about national ID cards, we all were up in arms about how we didn't like the idea all of our data was going to be stored in one place and the mess that the government would make of it, losing our data on CDs here, there and everywhere. Do you think that perhaps as we get cleverer and perhaps we do look at affiliate marketing and people realise we're targeting them with products that are using their data, they'll start to withdraw the information they're putting on the internet and stop giving away all the various details of the things they like and dislike, and actually we might get a situation where in fact the kind of online sharing space is kind of decreasing because people realise what they're offering up.
Fascinating question. I'm certainly intrigued to see how this unfolds as the increasingly savvy user base starts to want further ownership and control of our own data. What do you think, Mitch?
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, the users have to be in control of that or none of this works. And I think for the users that choose to be wide open, they will probably have a more contextual relationship with the media that they're getting because it'll be able to access that information about them. But it won't work unless the users have that, the control panel that says, yeah, share my name but not my birthday or, you know, whatever. I mean, all that stuff is really quite key. Whether you're talking about bringing things in or sending things out, the user needs to be able to have control of that, and it needs to make sense to them or else they won't know that they have control over it. So those are, that's where we focus our efforts, is making that control easier to understand.
We have a question there on the sofa.
Just add to that really quickly. I'll ask my friend over here, how much personal information is in your LastFM profile?
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely none, really, other than my name and a photo. But I think the standard client-facing answer to that question is it's all about value exchange, because basically what are you going to give me in return for the information that I give you? So Facebook asks, what movies do you like, what bands do you like, what brands do you eat, and so on and so forth, and I'm not telling it, no way, because I know what it's going to do with that information. Is it's going to sell me stuff that I don't care. I don't even know if LastFM does ask for that or not, I've not noticed. But the point is, I get a benefit out of what it knows about the information that I choose to share. So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, I was in a different city and I had a couple of nights to kill. Go into Ticketmaster and think, I wonder what I can do tonight. And there's like 200 events and you've got to scroll through loads of stuff that you may or may not like. You go to LastFM, it recommends you 5 things, but you like all of them. So it's actually giving you a benefit for the data that you exchange with it, plus the fact that I don't have to exchange anything that I don't want to. So it's about giving the user a return on what they're investing in you, I guess.
Thanks. So from that perspective, it's purely about this silo of music. If we can ask a birthday, only to try and work out different age groups and what they listen to. There's a city chart for cities all around the world. But at the end of the day, people fill out, we've got thousands of people who were born in 1900. That information is too personal for us. What we're trying to do is make the passion of music more relevant. So if you've got a profile, exactly as we talked about, you put your profile in and says, I'm in Paris, what the hell am I going to watch or see or do in music? That's all we're trying to do, and we are purely siloed in music.
I have a sense that whenever I hear these reassurances from the people who ask data of us, that there's this, oh, we don't do anything with it, we don't want much, and you can withdraw it at any time and all the rest of it, I think the end point of this increasingly aware audience is that the data actually retreats entirely back into a closed profile environment, such that the logic of it is that ultimately I'll be trading my data with people like you, and I'll be permitting you access to my data on the basis of a small fee, perhaps. I mean, that's the logic of the direction that we're moving in, I think, which I think perhaps is counter to the way most people think.
And that's what the brands are listening for, right? It's a conversation. It's not just about sending a message or hearing. It's more dynamic than that. It's a conversation. We know this about you, or you told this to us. Here's what we're going to tell you in exchange.
We have a question at the front, but I'm going to go to Omer first, and then to you. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. Look, this privacy stuff it's a big issue. But you know, from a strategic point of view, what's happening is really interesting because yeah, it's a big issue. But firms have to compete to be good today. They don't compete to be evil anymore. And in that kind of environment, people that misuse your data are shooting themselves in the foot. So, you know, and we see examples of this right here. And, the biggest example is Google, right? So we can argue whether they're sort of evil at the micro level, but one thing they don't do is sort of deliberately, deliberately impose costs on you with your data. So that notion, yeah. So that's one principle that, you know, I think gets lost in the middle of all of this stuff is that if firms have to be good and instead of evil, then a lot of these issues, they don't vaporize, but we have to look at them in very different ways, right? We have to start thinking about conversations instead of, you know, how do we hoard this stuff or close it or not let people access it. So.
But I mean, look, obviously the what's happening is that you used to pay for content, now you give data for content, right? That's the deal. As simple as that. You provide the data instead of the money. And in some cases, you provide both. I mean, this is the new advertising, right? You give your data, they send you shit that you're 100% sure that you're going to want to see, and they get the money from somebody else, right? That's the deal.
Well, yeah, it is the deal and it's not the deal. So the truth is that we've been obsessed by this issue of, you know, who owns the data? Who owns the data? Who owns the data for years and years and years? And I remember going to a conference in New York in 2000, I don't know, 6 or something, where this was the big issue, right? Who owns the data? What is the future of owning the data? And the truth is, you know, yes, that is the dynamic, but that also means that data is a commodity, right? So more data is created today than was created yesterday. And that's true going forward, yeah? So in that kind of world, who owns the data becomes less important than who's plugged into the flows of the data, yeah? And that's what MySpace, I think, is really... hopefully getting good at, and Last.fm as well to an extent. So I think it's as much about owning the data. When you are good, you get people to, share more data with you. And I think data is a bad word for it, but if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you. A question up at the front.
It's kind of leading on from that topic, bring it back to brands and the conversation earlier about value. After the last Chinwag measurement event. Will McKinney sat over there, set up the measurement wiki, and I went to the last one. And what was very interesting is that we began to start discussions on how you measure this in order to convince people to invest. Primarily, from my interest, it's brands, getting brands to invest in listening and in dialogue. And I'd like to ask the panel if they believe what we were beginning to believe, which is that old world metrics don't apply, and if they don't apply, what does apply, and how can we convince brands and investors to hand the dosh over?
So tell us what you mean by metrics here, before we go on.
Well, old world metrics in terms of, one of the very typical ones is how many visitors you get to a site, which is a very old world metric, or how many people will sit down and watch Coronation Street.
Okay, metrics for micromedia, social media, and the rest. Come on, guys.
I think at the end of the day, where I am with this, which is probably completely different to everybody else, is that we're still human beings. And something has to happen for us to choose one brand over another. So advertising, in whatever form it is, has to make us do something that the advertiser wants. Now, whether that's build a relationship with us through pushing a story and building a story around their brand, whether it's still the 10-second spot on Coronation Street, It's. I don't think the difference is as transparent as we all think it is. What is different is the way that people are consuming media and consuming different ways. And at the end of the day, clients in this country still look at the old school ways of measuring. Moving forward, what's happening is we've already mentioned this. You know, P&G and Unilever. I mean, Axe is a great, great example. I don't know if you ever see. Have you seen the Axe video of the town in the US on YouTube, where they produce this video of a totally male town and imported a load of women, and it was to do with the Axe brand. And for me, Unilever, an old-fashioned company, waking up to this. But at the end of the day, it's about us going, okay, well, I'm going to buy a Persil Axe. You know, it's engaging with us. What engages me and what engages everybody else is completely different. But unfortunately, the measurement for this hasn't really moved on. I think we've kind of touched on this. But you know, when we got Barb, which is a panel of what 5,000 homes, I could be wrong actually, 5,000 homes, 10,000, or whatever it is, you know, and then that Barb panel then controls billions of pounds worth of spend. At what point do clients go, hang on a minute, this is not working? Well, it comes to a point when it doesn't work. Sales still spike. You know, you put a 10-second spot in Coronation Street. EPOS next day says, oh, sales gone up. They come down again pretty quickly, but that's been happening for 10 years. So, you know, until we can find a way of actually measuring this and pushing it through, yeah, it's tough because a lot of clients are in that inertia because they've got to report to a board and that report reports to the PLC and the PLC has to do these figures. We're a bit stuffed. It will happen, but it's just going to take a bit of time.
My finely tuned audience radar suggests that there's a weariness and the bar is open and so on. So we're going to take one more question at the back there. Okay, and then unless anybody's really, really keen to come in with another question, I'm going to wind it up. Go ahead.
Quick question. I'm Nico Flores from BBC Strategy. When someone embeds a widget on another site, especially if the second site is a blogging platform or a social network site, sometimes money changes hands between the owners of the blogging platform or the social network site and the widget company. How big do you think that is to the panel generally late in the last year and compared to advertising specifically? And do you think that end users will ever get to share any of that?
So the question is, widget owners or widget creators are paying for tenancies, as it were, on platforms like Typepad and so on, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, that's, without naming names, that sort of thing is happening. I wonder how big that is compared to direct advertising.
But you make it sound like it's kind of surreptitious and perhaps they shouldn't, they're not allowed to do that kind of thing.
No, not at all. No, no. You know? But I've never heard of the actual numbers, so I'm wondering if the panel could give a rough idea.
Okay. They all look like they know. Any ideas?
Well, for us, we felt like that wasn't a very scalable option to reach out to all the widget providers because it's endless. I mean, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of widgets out there, and you know, for us, what we've done is we've decided to try and create a monetization model for the widget owners within our site using display ads. So they can put ads right next to the install section of their widget on the Canvas page, or for an app or that kind of thing. So we're actually trying to help spur on the widget economy for the widget providers rather than to scrape off the top on that.
Are you not charging them at all?
No, we're not charging them a thing. The users? No, we're not. No, we're not charging YouTube anything.
It's all done from a sort of charitable point of view. It's very.
It just
touching.
It drives usage, right? If that's what the users want, then that's what the users get, and then they keep coming back.
Anybody else want to address that question? Money changing hands, dirty concept. We don't like that, do we? No. All right. So. Let's stop now. I would like you all to give a big round of applause to my panel, who have been fantastic.
Chinwag Live Micromedia Maze, held in London on May 20th, 2008, was sponsored by DoubleClick and the UKTI. More information can be found on www.chinwag.com.